Listener-supported KTOO. Welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Wednesday, March 5th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunath Chish, Hawa, Toexuk Nusum, Salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. Today, a preview of this Friday's fireside lecture, The Fish That Saw the 20th Century, a journey through history during the life of a rockfish. And we'll also talk about the ADF and G statewide rockfish initiative. We chat with the high school debate and drama team ahead of their fundraising dinner this Saturday, March 8th. Kate is here from the City Museum with details on the openings of the annual 12x12 community art exhibition and Francis Davis's Landscapes and Portraits. And the Juno Arts and Humanities Council features Monica Doherty in the gallery for March. Those conversations coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com.
Proposition. When you're headed for some fun in the sun and do some fishing, if you get protected species or you meet your rockfish quota, always be prepared if you
land them in your boat.
Angler party boat and it's starting to rock. The genus is Sebastes and we like it quite a lot. It means magnificent in language of the Greeks. Some cool fish effluvia for ichthyo geeks. Yellow eye, vermilion, and canary are a few. Get to know your rockfish and what you should do. Have a rig and a plan how to get them to the bottom. Have a heart, do your part, and send them down to where you got them.
Like a rock,
drop them back down to the bottom.
Send them back to the back,
send them back to where you got them.
Let it roll,
as they fade in their decision. Drop the barrel, drop a drum, hey. Rockfish recompression.
Hey. Going from the deep, the gas bladder expands. Got their stomach in their mouth, now the time is at hand. Exophthalmia abounds and the eyes are bugging too. Don't you go and poke them, cause that's just cruel. Barbless hook, milk crate, don't be a fool. Commercial fish descender or a recompression tool. Got so many ways now to get the job done. Till you're not a hassle, it can even be fun.
You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at KTOO. That right there is a little bit of a song called, it is the Rockfish Barotrauma music video. It was done by a bunch of people, and it's very fun. Ray Troll, who helped out and gave some of his artwork, and also was part of that fun jam right there. So very cool. We appreciate the folks from that rock song, which was pretty fun. This Friday, and it's all in fun because it's part of this Friday, March 7th at 7 p.m., the Fireside Lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. It has a fantastic title. The Fish That Saw the 20th Century, an exploration of history during the life of a rockfish. There will also be some talk on the Alaska Department of Fish and Game statewide rockfish initiative. And now I'm joined by the two presenters, Jan Rumble, Southeast Program Coordinator for Groundfish and Shellfish for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Gunath Chish, for being here.
Thank you, Boston. Thanks a lot.
Of course. And Aaron Baldwin, Southeast Groundfish Biologist, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Gunath Chish, washa'iati, Aaron. Yeah, absolutely. So Gunath Chish, Hayadi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you both here in the studio. So let's talk rockfish. Jan's got her charts and her numbers.
I do. I have my little props here so I don't forget anything. But it's interesting that you picked that song because It's about deep water release of rockfish, which is really important in Southeast and around the state. It's actually a regulation now that went into effect in 2020, so that if you have caught your limit of rockfish, you have to have a deep water release mechanism on board, and you need to put the ones back down that, you know, that go over your bag limit. So even before that, Ray Troll was making this awesome video and trying to encourage people to, you know, to deep water release, and now it's actually in regulation. So I know I'm like the boring person in this presentation. Aaron's the guy with the creativity, but I'm the gal with the regulations. But so we're giving this talk on Friday. I'm doing the boring part, talking about the initiative, which is very important. And Aaron's going to do a talk about an otolith that was found, one of the oldest fish that we've aged, you know, with their otoliths, yellow-eye rockfish, which is near and dear to a lot of our hearts here in Southeast Alaska and around the state, including Prince William Sound and Cook Inlet, North Gulf Coast. So we'll be giving information about it. The statewide rockfish initiative was started about 8 years ago when the Department of Fish and Game realized that we had an increase in the harvest of rockfish species because of the decrease in harvest of halibut and king salmon. And so pressure was put on rockfish, and we started to see these increases, and we decided to get together with the Sport Fish Division and the Commercial Fisheries Division to kind of find our information gaps, start doing some serious stock assessment, and figure out where we were with these different groups. Black rockfish and yellow eye were the first ones that we picked. And so we've been working on those for 8 years, and we've had some regulations recently that have address some of these issues of increased sport harvest, and there have been some decreased bag limits. Obviously, people in Southeast know that yellow eye was closed since 2020, but this year there will be opportunity because we've seen a little bit of an uptick for yellow eye in this area. So I feel like I've been talking a bunch, and I want to get to some fun stuff that Aaron has to talk about. But this group is important to us, and it's important to understand where we're at and make sure that we're doing what's right for the resource.
Absolutely. So, Aaron, are you covering the part about the fish that saw the through the 20th century? Is that what you're covering? All right. So tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. So this talk is going to be centered around it's a rockfish that was caught in 2021 that was aged at 121 years. So it was born in 1900.
Oh, wow.
So it literally lived through the entire 20th century. So As a young person, a little bit of history of this. As a young person, I was heavily influenced by, you know, the Muir Woods, the famous Tree of Time display with the redwood cut with the markings on it. It was used in the movie Vertigo.
Right.
The Hitchcock movie. It's profound to look at something and go, my grandfather was born here, and, you know, these kinds of things. And so I thought something like that would be a great way to show, to make the human aspect of it. This fish was alive during these events in human history. Mm. So it was alive when the first radio broadcast was made. It was alive when the U.S. entered World War II. It was, all of these events that happened.
When spam was created. Well, actually, spam was probably created before
the,
that.
The first airplane and the moon landing
happened
while this fish was alive. Yeah. And so I think that's a profound way to kind of to it's one thing to say, wow, rockfish are very old. It's another thing to be able to look at. So what we created was a cross-section of this otolith on a large poster that has these marked on it, like the Tree of Time display, where there's arrows pointing to, you know, the First World War started. Women were given the right to vote. These events that happened while this fish was alive.
And is there something about the evolution of the rockfish over this time during that same period, or no?
I have a little picture that kind of shows a juvenile and maturing and then older rockfish. But no, the only thing I put in there is that outside of that is I have little boxes that says, you know, this fish probably reproduced this year for the first time.
Oh, wow.
And so, there are different, there's 25 different rockfish that we know of in Alaska. And so they each have different life histories. So black rockfish are not as long lived as yellow eye. And Rockfish are one of the ones that we're focused on with our state Rockfish initiative. So it's a diverse group of fish that have different life histories, which is fascinating.
Yeah, really. It is fascinating. And do they not normally live to be that long, or was it this particular one just because it was born in 1900 that made it interesting to you?
The species is long-lived. This rockfish happened to be, I believe it was the second one that was the same age, 121.
Okay.
But those are the two oldest yellow-eye rockfish known.
What's the average age?
I don't know the average age, but
I don't know what the average age is, but just to compare, the black rockfish, the maximum age that we've seen in Alaska is 57. So that's half of what that yellow eye, that old yellow eye was. And then the fecundity for the yellow eye is, you know, up to 3 million eggs, one yellow eye. So it's pretty amazing.
So let's talk a little bit about the initiative, because you're going to cover this history, which is going to be really fascinating. And then you're also going to be describing a little bit about the initiative, which you talked about just a little bit. But tell us about what that is and what we need to know.
Well, it's a group of people, about 25 participants from the Sport Fish Division and the Commercial Fisheries Division. And we've been meeting for about 8 years now. We have different committees that we each have expertise on. We have a communication and outreach committee. We have a group of people that works on the stock assessment to decide, like, where we're at at any one time for these different stocks. We have a group that looks at things like, are they related, the genetics? Are Kodiak black rockfish related to Cook Inlet or related to Southeast? Are these different? Should they be looked at different? Should they be managed differently? So we have committees that have these different kind of projects that they're working on. We had a harvest reconstruction group that kind of put together the harvest through, you know, back into the early 1900s to understand, like, where we started with our harvest. And then we, you know, eventually this comes into regulation and we can present our results at Board of Fisheries meetings like we had last month in Ketchikan, where we presented the information that we have from our stock assessment to allow the Board of Fish to understand where we're at so they can adjust bag limits, help us out with deciding what seasons were, you know, how long seasons are, if we're going to open this, if we're going to open that, if we're going to decrease bag limits. All these decisions are made with the input of this bigger group.
I see. Okay, that's fascinating. That's going to be so fun. So this is, again, we're talking about the Fireside Lecture that's happening this Friday. It's at 7 p.m. out at Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Jan Rumbel and Aaron Baldwin will be out there talking about this. And what is it, who should attend this talk, I guess?
I think anybody should attend. And I think it would be great for kids as well, because Aaron's poster, which we'll have there, is so visual. And Aaron is an amazing speaker, and he's very entertaining. He does a great job at it. And just having kids there, I think, will just make things really great if we could have entire families.
Families are good. And Aaron, where did you first find the love? I love your shirt, by the way. Where did you first find the love of the thing you work on now in terms of rockfish? Where did that come to you?
I've always been, like, my entire life, of interested in the ocean and what's in it. Rockfish in particular, I used to be a fisheries observer. So, you know, being on deck with, you know, a dozen different species and having to sort them into piles, you either love them or jump overboard. you learn to appreciate.
Yeah, absolutely.
The little subtleties, the little spines that make the difference between species and such. So
I just love the fact that, you know, you have such an interest in it. I think that's really cool. And you're doing the work, right? Doing the work to make it better, to help figure out how we can incorporate all of that into what we do on a daily basis, a seasonal basis, in terms of how we go about harvesting the rockfish, right?
And understanding, you know, the reasons behind our, you know, guideline harvest levels or our bag limits, and understanding how that all works together in the you know, in the realm of conservation of rockfish, I think is important, and just knowing about their life history is it makes kids and adults appreciate it more and understand, you know, the regulations and the meaning behind them.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for coming in, Gunathichish, for being here. It is the Friday, March 7th at 7 p.m. Fireside Lecture at the Mendenhall Visitor Center. It has a fantastic title, The Fish That Saw the 20th Century. You're going to see Aaron's poster and an exploration of history during the life of a rockfish. And then also Jan will be there to not talk about the boring stuff, Jan. It's all interesting stuff. It's all really important. She'll go over the initiative that is part of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Thank you so much, Gunathichish, for being here today. I really appreciate you.
Thank you.
Okay. Up next, we will talk with the high school debate and drama team ahead of their special fundraising dinner this weekend. This is Juno Afternoon from KTOO.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Kahuan Ish George Davis. And the word this week is kutia.
Kutia.
That means totem pole. And here's a sentence.
Kutia akawa chako.
He carved a totem pole. Let's hear it again.
Kutia.
Totem pole. Gunathichish to Hune Lance Twitchell, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Kahuan Ish, George Davis was Tukdain Tan and the child of a Tsagwe Di man. He grew up in Qiq, Cake, Alaska, and learned to speak well because he would always bring traditional foods to the elders there. As someone who fished a lot and spent time on the land, he knew Tlingit place names all over the area, and he learned many stories and advanced ways of speaking.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Saturday, March 8th, the Drama Debate Showcase from Juno Douglas High School, Yada'akathle, will take place in the school commons from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. It will feature drama, debate, speaking showcases, plus food and a silent auction. And I'm honored to welcome now to the studio a bunch of students. I know I think I have Elijah, I think I have Luke, and I think I have Peyton, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then I have one additional ad. Who are you, sir?
I'm Casey.
Hi, Casey. Nice to meet you. Pleasure to have you all here. Gunathichish, Hat Yadi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to get you all in the studio. So, Wasiati, I'm going to say you're Luke.
Elijah,
okay. So you must be Luke.
I am Luke.
You're Luke, and you're Peyton.
Yes.
Okay, and your name once again?
Casey.
Okay, and get just a little bit closer to that microphone, Casey, when you speak. I know we're sharing a mic over there. Pretend like you like each other and you're on the debate team, right?
Shouldn't be too hard.
Okay, so let's first talk about the drama and debate team. Just to let you know, you are talking to the 1987 state champion in debate.
Fingers crossed for that.
There you go.
Very nice.
Resolved that the federal government should institute a comprehensive agriculture policy in the United States. That was nice what we ran on. That was the resolve or whatever it was back in the day. So which of you are doing debate?
That'd be us.
Everyone
that's,
but me.
Everyone but you. Okay. All right. Luke is doing something else. So now, when I was doing debate, it was two people and two people, mm-hmm. and it was the sort of that style, right? Is it still that way, or do you do other styles now? Yeah, Peyton.
Yeah. So here in Southeast, we do a style called public forum debate, which is exactly like that. I'm assuming it's probably the same thing that you did, where two teams of two people go against each other.
Okay. And then you have like the first person goes and then they get cross-examined and then mm-hmm. the other team goes. So you have the affirmative and the negative, right?
Yes.
In terms of the – and what is the resolve this year?
The resolve for this year was, should the United States accede to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court?
What? Say that one more time.
Should the United States accede to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court?
Okay. And so how do you all break that down? What did you decide to do? And now do you change your – okay. So how did you start on that one? What did you first do?
Well, I'll tell you, Boston. The first thing I did was something that our coach always tells us to do, define every single word in there.
Yes.
Going from accede all the way down to should.
I mean, ought to, but not necessarily will.
Yeah, going into this, I didn't really even know what accede means, but kind of just means to join and accept the terms of a contract or negotiation, which is what the Rome Statute is.
Okay. Yeah. And what is the – tell me what the Rome Statute is again.
The Rome Statute is essentially the rule book of the International Criminal Court. It is the founding document, and if you accede to it, it essentially means you're accepting the rules of the International Criminal Court.
I see. Okay. Now, do you all still carry like bags and bags of evidence with you to every debate? Like, do you still use paper, or is it all electronic now?
Some of our teams use electronic stuff now. I personally prefer having all of the paper evidence and stuff. But there's definitely a lot of evidence that we bring into every debate, whether it's paper or it's a computer.
See, there's something really intimidating about having like a mound of evidence in your back pocket. Mm-hmm. Right?
Definitely.
So you get those like airline pilot bags and you just fill it up with folders. And we used a lot of 3x5 index cards. Do you still use index cards or how do you do it?
Some teams do. A lot of the Southeast teams don't use index cards as much. A lot of the time we'll take citations from websites and things and then put them all into one big document and print off that.
Okay. And are you still doing the thing where you – I know I'm geeking out here because I love debate. Debate is so fun. Do you still do a flow chart as you're going in the – you know, do you have like – are you, your last – you know, rebuttals or whatever, you're always going, well, they didn't carry this argument all the way through. They didn't carry this argument all the way through, so we win. Do you still do that, Peyton?
I personally do. A lot of people do. A lot of people don't. It really just depends on the individual.
I think Peyton seems to be like somebody who is a really good cross-examiner.
Oh, yeah.
That she is.
I believe I am.
I believe I am. I love that. That's so good.
Okay. I can vouch for that.
Yeah, I bet. And which are you partnered up here in terms of you is Elijah your partner?
So me and Casey were debate partners.
You were partners,
region,
okay.
State in the previous meet.
Okay.
Elijah is paired with somebody else named Olivia Gomez.
Okay, I got you. Okay, yeah, all right. And then Luke, let's talk a little bit about. I'm sure they all are doing the drama as well, but
oh, yeah,
you
are.
Do some of the drama. Which, what does that include?
So we have a couple different things you can do for drama, but essentially it's taking pieces from movie scripts, plays, books, anything you think would make a good performance, and cutting it down into smaller increments. So for example, I have a duet from The Devil Wears Prada, and we're taking that two-hour movie and cutting it into a 10-minute story.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. So you do 10 minutes of it?
There's different time limits for different events. So,
okay.
For example, duets, 10 minutes, but the highest you can go for any drama event is 12 minutes. So you still have to do a good bit of cutting.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then there's still, do you still do like solo where you do like monologues and
stuff?
Oh,
yeah, that's right. We still have those.
All right. That's awesome. And then do you still do, I guess this falls under the debate or the forensics part of it. Is there still extemporaneous and or expository and all those things that you still do?
Definitely. Yeah, we still have extemporaneous speaking and extemporaneous commentary. So speaking is going to be like political subjects. There's foreign and domestic. So foreign is going to be all sorts of like international topics and relations. And then domestic stuff is going to be political things within the United States. Commentary, a lot of the time, will be just fun topics that you can then take and kind of run with however you want. It's still around and it's still a ton of fun.
That's awesome. And I know that Casey was talking about learning just even in the resolve that you have to break down the words and figure it out. You start to learn stuff. But what are some of the things that you are capturing by being on the debate and drama team in terms of like life lessons or things that you're carrying with you in terms of like education?
Sure. Go ahead, Casey.
Well, I find specifically with debate, it has helped me immensely with critical thinking skills and just going over not just the side that I initially want to believe in, but going over both sides of an argument has really helped me in decision making and critical thinking about everything in general.
I love that. Peyton.
Additionally, on that note, having two different sides that you both have to study, it really opens your mind to other perspectives that you may not be open to before. It makes you realize that no matter what, there is evidence on both sides of every issue.
Yeah, that is so true, right, Elijah? Especially when you find evidence that you can use for your case, but then somebody on the other side is going to have something that refutes that exact same thing, right?
Definitely, yeah. As you go through a debate, you'll find something that you're like, this is a surefire argument. There's no rebuttal to this. And then the next day, you're going to find something that goes directly against it. And you never find something that is perfectly a solid argument. There's always going to be a rebuttal, and there's always going to be a point against it. And that is so... That concept in the real life is so important to understand, because there's never such a thing as a perfect argument to defend your point.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about this, that I, in my day, we didn't have social media, we didn't have, you know, so are you still bound by certain rules when it comes to what kind of evidence is, like, we used to think was, like, Reader's Digest was not considered a good source, right, for a document, like, to factually document something. Do you still have rules like that, Peyton, where you want to be using, like, U.S. News and World Report or the New York Times, or can you use things that are on social media these days?
You can really use everything that you want to. There's no rules against using certain things. But if somebody calls you out on it, then you might be screwed.
Right. If they, what, how do they get back? What's backing it up, right? Like, what's backing that up? Yeah, because people can say anything they want, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we got to talk about this event that's happening on Saturday. This is a dinner and showcase, which is really kind of cool. It's Saturday, March 8th. It's the drama and debate team from Juno Douglas High School, Yedaa Katle. And it is going to be fantastic. It looks like there's pulled pork and there's some side dishes and all that kind of stuff. What are we going to be seeing here, Luke, on Saturday?
Oh, all kinds of things. So we're putting together some of our best performing, most entertaining speeches and drama events to make a, I think it's about an hour and a half long show. So we're going to have, let me pull up my actual schedule here so I can give you an exact list of events. We're going to open with a pantomime, which is a super cool event. This one got a command at the state tournament. So this event is a story told with no words at all, just through physical action and some music. They also have some very fun costumes, I happen to know. And then we go into some speeches. There's going to be a couple duo duet events. Basically, it's all of our most fun crowd-pleasing events from the year.
Awesome. That's so good. And then what are the this is a fundraiser, right?
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
Okay. And it's a fundraiser for what? Travel money? Or?
Yes. So a big part of it is going towards travel money, because we had to take 15 kids to state up in Anchorage this week. And it costs about $500 each. So it's a large amount of money to bring these students up to compete. And all of the funds going towards this are going to be going directly into reimbursing those students for that travel cost.
I see. So how did we do at state?
We did phenomenal at state. We had state champions in three different events. We had many other finalists in states. And also, our team, the Juno Douglas High School team, we came first overall, collecting the most points out of every single school in Alaska.
Wow. Congratulations. That's awesome. That's pretty good. And what were the three top winners?
So, two of them right here.
Oh, you yes. And you. All right.
So we came first in public forum debate, which was Elijah Goins and Olivia Gomez. We came first in pantomime, which is Dane Hubert and Freddie Thorstenson. And we came first in informative speaking, which was me, Peyton Edmonds.
Informative speaking. Okay, that's where you do a speech by yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
On a topic. And what was your topic, Peyton?
My topic was fake news.
Fake news. That's a good one. That's a real good one these days. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And so this dinner and showcase, everyone's invited, right? The public
Absolutely.
Is invited. There's tickets available. How do we get tickets?
So for tickets, you can either reach out if you happen to know a DDF kid. They will be selling tickets, or we will be selling tickets at the door for the showcase.
Okay, you're selling tickets at the door. I also see that James, your coach, also put his email on the flyer, james.marks@junoschools.org, if you're interested in getting more information about a ticket. Or it's $20 throw down when you get to the door. You'll get to see all these fantastic students performing various different things. It's all to support the travel fund and just the debate, the overall state champs.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, see, I didn't know that information. That's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah, and one thing I will mention is $20 for a ticket, but for people who are 13 and under, it's only $10. So make sure to bring your kids, bring your family.
Yeah, because you want to get your youngins interested, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of this kind of thing, because I think it's going to be it's a wonderful lateral skills no matter what you go into. I know a lot of people think, oh, if you're in debate or drama, well, drama, you know you're probably going to go on and do something like that. But in debate, like I didn't really participate in the drama side. I did all the debate and forensic stuff, even though I was also in the drama. You know, mm-hmm. in the theater and stuff. And but it's really interesting because you don't know where you're going to land. I think a lot of people think, oh, if you're in debate, you're going to become a lawyer or something like that. Real quick, before we have to go, I don't know where you are in your collegiate or in your high school careers, but do you have an idea yet of what you're thinking about doing, Casey?
Yeah, well, I am currently waiting on a response from the Air Force Academy. I'm hoping to go there and become a fighter pilot. So that's my goal.
Awesome. Luke?
I'm only a junior, but I'm planning on being an author, so listeners, pray for me.
Peyton.
I'm likely going to be studying pre-law at Willamette University and later going on to law school.
Ah, yeah, you seem like. You definitely seem like you're going to be the one to be a lawyer. I love it. And Elijah?
I'll probably be going into electrical engineering at Oregon State University.
Electrical engineering?
Mm-hmm.
Why that?
I've always been fascinated with electronics and how things work, and my dad's a civil engineer, so I got a lot of inspiration from him in just making things work and building things over the years.
I love that. That's so great. Well, Elijah, Peyton, Luke, Casey, congratulations on being the state champs, number one overall. Congratulations
to you
for your individuals. The dinner and showcase is this Saturday, March 8th, featuring drama, debate, and speaking showcases, a silent auction, pulled pork rolls, and other various side dishes. It's really great to have you all here. And how do we follow the team? Do you have a Facebook page?
So we do have an Instagram page, and that is going to be at JunoDDF with no period, no spaces.
JunoDDF. Awesome. Mm-hmm. I'm going to follow it right after the show today. Thank you so much, Gunzatish, for being here.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you
so
much.
Thank you.
Okay, up next, we talk with the Juneau Douglas City Museum, as they have multiple openings this first Friday. We'll break it all down with Kate Ross next here on Juneau Afternoon from KTOO. But first, a savory moment.
Step in to the savory moment. Ancient grains is a marketing term used to describe the seeds of edible grasses that have been enjoyed by people for a really long time. Since the pharaohs ruled Egypt, or human beings began cultivating cereal crops roughly 12,000 years ago in places like modern-day Syria and Iraq. To understand what an ancient grain is, let's start with what it isn't. Any cereal that has undergone selective breeding over the centuries is no longer an ancient grain. This includes the wheat we bake with today, bred and rebred to produce larger yields and resistance to disease. The same is true of modern oats, rice, and corn. Here are a few cereals that do qualify. Einkorn, considered the oldest cultivated grain and the mother of modern wheat. Farro, spelt, Khorasan wheat, sometimes called kamut, along with teff, black barley, amaranth, and millet, which are actually seeds still encased in their seed coats. All evolved from wild grasses that first appeared on Earth about 66 million years ago. Talk about vintage. How do we know these grains were cultivated as far back as the Neolithic Revolution when people began trading in their spears for hoes? Archaeobotanists, scientists who study plant material associated with human civilizations, have found charred remains, imprints on pottery fragments, even cemented into the tartar of human teeth. Are there any grain recipes from the Neolithic? Scientists haven't located any index cards, but they have found the residue of recipes. In Northern Europe, one team scraped 6,000-year-old food crusts from cooking pots to reveal the DNA of ancient grains cooked with marine animals and a spicy plant called garlic mustard. Find the recipe for Neolithic barley soup with seafood and spicy greens at savorymoment.org. From the studios of KCAW in Sitka, Alaska, I'm Beth Short Rhodes. Whatever is on your dinner table tonight, may you savor the moment.
You are listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Rhythm, the 21st annual 12 by 12 community art exhibition opens this Friday at the Juno Douglas City Museum. And it's not the only opening this Friday at the museum. They have another opening. Francis Davis, Landscapes and Portraits, also begins. Plus, there's grant applications are now open for a couple different programs. And here to get us caught up is Kate Ross from the museum. Thank you so much, Kate. Wasiati, how's it going?
Good, good. Yeah. I had that little taste of sunshine last couple days, and I'm trying to hold on to that feeling.
Spring is so close.
It's so close. My kid keeps asking if it's officially spring. I'm like, not quite. Yeah. We're almost there.
March 21st. Now, isn't that when we go into the...
It's coming up quick. That's the equinox.
That's the official. But really, it's about when we feel the sun.
How does it feel in your heart?
Yeah. That's I had the sun come in my office window the other day, and I was like, okay, now we're talking. This is good. I like that. Okay, so we got a lot to talk about, not a lot of time. So let's go. We've got two openings this week. Run them down for us.
Yeah. So in our little bit smaller community gallery room, we have Francis Davis, Landscapes and Portraits. So Francis Davis was a painter, an incredible woman who was very, very prolific as well, and just painted and sketched and made a huge body of work. And this was over 100 years ago at this point. So we have a number of her pieces in our permanent collection. And since March is Women's History Month, we have that exhibit up celebrating her work. And it's a beautiful exhibit. It has a couple pages from one of her sketchbooks, and there's some portraits and really, really cool. Some of my favorites are some smaller paintings of ice and glaciers. So like icebergs and glaciers with these beautiful, deep, moody blues. And some other landscapes with alpenglow and sunsets, and so it's very cool. It looks a lot more like an old master's version of Alaskana landscapes compared to some of the things you might see in more contemporary Alaskan art. So that's really cool. So that's in our little bit smaller gallery there for Francis Davis, and then it's 12 by 12 time.
Is it officially 12 by 12, or can we just call it officially 12 by 12?
By 12. We can call it 12 by 12 by 12 by 12. You could keep going, really. I think we can add them on.
So tell us about it, and then also let us know, are there some 3D pieces?
Oh, there are. Okay. So, yeah, it's the 21st annual 12 by 12 community art exhibit, and the theme this year is rhythm. Mm. And so we have our largest. Last year was our largest. This year we broke our record again. We have close to 60 pieces.
Wow.
Yep. And so there's a number that are from a group of students. So that's pretty cool. There's a bunch of student artwork as part of it. And then just a ton of different takes on rhythm. And some are kind of taking it more literally, or people dancing or things like that. Some are taking the rhythm of maybe patterns or textures and things like that, or the rhythms of things in nature. There's one I particularly like of a cat. And you can see its tail, and it's showing the rhythm of the tail moving, which is very cool. But we do have some 3D pieces, which are very, very fun. And we have a couple that even make noise and move.
Oh, my goodness. We're getting complicated.
I know. People just keep getting more and more creative.
That's so fun. And how did the theme of rhythm come about?
You know, every year we take submissions from people. We always have a sign-up sheet, or not a sign-up sheet, but just a sheet for people to write down ideas for themes. And then all of us at the museum, the staff at the museum, spend time just bandying those themes around and thinking about what would be fun and what we think would garner a huge amount of different types of things from the community as well, right? We don't want to pick something that's too specific of a theme and only get kind of one type of thing. So we would like it to be something broad and open to interpretation. And so we thought rhythm would be fun.
I love it because it's like one word, but like you said, you can interpret that in so many different ways.
So many ways, yeah. And so this show really, there's a lot of different takes on what rhythm means.
And will this show be up for just the month of March, or is it going going to last a little bit longer?
It'll be through April. And so both of the shows, Rhythm and the Francis Davis exhibit, will both be up through mid-April. So they're up for about a month and a half. And then that gives us a little bit of time to switch everything around to get ready for our summer exhibit.
Okay, and let us know about the openings this Friday in terms of reception and time. And is the museum still free right now?
Yeah. So we have our first Friday opening reception for both of those exhibits from 4 to 7 this Friday, March 7th. And yeah, the museum is still free all the way, even though, I don't want to say it too loud, even though the ships are around the corner, we are free all the way until, all the way until the very beginning of May. So all the way through April. So for the next 2 months or a month and a half, you can come see these exhibits and everything else at the museum for free. This month, our generous community sponsor is Michelle Storer. So thanks to her generosity, we're able to, have the museum open for free and Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 4 still.
Okay, great. That's all good. And of course, you can always find more at juno.org/museum. But we have a couple other things to talk about because you have some applications for grants that are opening up.
Yeah. So the first deadline is April 3rd is the deadline for the Juno History Grant. There's actually two deadlines per year, so there's one in October as well. But April 3rd, keep it in mind. And this is open to anybody with basically any type of project or interest in something they want to look into or develop that has something to do with Juno Douglas history. These grants are usually on the smaller side, somewhere between $500 to maybe $1,500 or $2,000. Really, it's just anything related to history. It could be performance art or wanting to write a book, or it's pretty open.
Okay.
And then the next deadline is May 1st is the annual Marie Darlin Prize deadline. And so this used to be something that you had to nominate someone for. So there was a nomination process. But starting last year, we have opened it up now just for submissions. So it's not as – we're trying to keep it a little bit more accessible for people. So you don't have to be nominated or nominate someone else. You can submit for yourself or for someone on behalf of someone else.
Okay. And the Marie Darlin Prize covers – like what kind of things does it cover in terms of who should be considering to apply?
Yeah. So the Marie Darlin Prize is really for anybody with – either a body of work or a history of work and projects relating to Southeast Alaska history. Again, we're always looking for Juno Douglas, but this is a little broader. It can be Southeast Alaska. And previous prize winners have been in we had Lily Hope was last year's in kind of recognition of her contributions to weaving and teaching weaving and everything with that. This year's winner is our 2024 winner, gets weird with the timing, but was
right.
Scott Burton for his work with filmmaking and some language projects that he's worked on, Tlingit language projects he's worked on. We've had Ernestine Hayes and Maureen Longworth, so playwrights and authors and, culture bearers. And so that again, is a pretty open open thing, but it is looking for someone who is of pretty large standing in the community, I would say, someone who has that body of work or experience behind them.
Because you get $5,000, right?
Yeah, it's $5,000. And the fun thing about the Marie Darlin Prize, is that is a prize. It's a prize. It's prize money. It's not actually a grant. And so you win it or you nominate someone for that prize money because you think they've been doing an amazing job in their field and they deserve that money. And there's no stipulations like other grants for it. It's not, it doesn't have to be used on something specific. There's no grant reporting. It really is just going to recognize and uplift people who have made significant contributions to our local history and culture.
I love that. Okay, give us a breakdown one more time of the shows opening this week.
Yeah, the Francis Davis Landscapes and Portraits, a female painter from around 100 years ago in celebration of Women's History Month. That is, and then the 12x12, 21st annual 12x12, this year's theme is Rhythm. And both of those open this Friday, 4 to 7 o'clock, first Friday reception.
And you can find out more at juno.org/museum or follow on probably all the socials, right?
Yep, we're on them. You gotta be.
Thanks so much, Kate. Gunnath Sheesh for being here. We'll see you next month.
Gunnath Sheesh.
Absolutely. Okay, up next, we will talk with the Juno Arts and Humanities Council for more First Friday goodness. But first, bird note.
This is Bird Note. When biologist Danielle Whitaker started studying bird odors, some scientists tried to discourage her. They repeated an old myth: birds can't smell. But that only deepened her curiosity.
When I first heard the idea that birds didn't have a sense of smell, they suddenly became this mysterious puzzle I had to study.
She was drawn further into the world of bird scent when she caught a whiff of her favorite bird, the brown-headed cowbird.
The first time I caught a brown-headed cowbird, I had it in a paper bag the way we hold captive birds. And when I opened that bag, it just smelled like fresh cookies. And I couldn't believe it. I took the bird out and I sniffed that bird, and it was like a sugar cookie. And every cowbird I've caught since then smells like cookies to me.
Danielle and her colleagues studied dark-eyed juncos and found that these birds produce many odors during the breeding season. Linked to the bird's sex hormones, these odors help signal readiness to mate and how aggressive an individual is.
There were a number of us who finally started looking at behavior in birds and finally started to see that they were using odor. It really started to raise awareness in the scientific community that, hey, this is actually something birds can do.
Learn more in Danielle Whitaker's book, The Secret Perfume of Birds, Uncovering the Science of Avian Scent. Find a link on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Connor Guerin.
Hans and Gress, ka eat with the shu yi, we ka shuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta ka na khaya ha an ka gnish cheese.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akwan. The Klenny D have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages, and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations. Listening to Community Supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm Boston Christopher. More First Friday goodness this week. I'm joined now by Tracy Ferguson Hayes from the Juno Arts and Humanities Council and featured gallery artist for the month of March, Monica Doherty. Monica Wasiti, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Thanks, Boston.
Awesome. And Tracy, how are you?
Doing great.
Good.
Glad to be here.
Gwyneth Cheese for being here. I really appreciate it. All right. So let's start with anything else that we need to know before we talk to Monica. What else is going on at the Jack? Because I know there's a couple other things.
There are so many things going on just for First Friday in general. But specifically at the Jack, I do want to plug in our scholarship and grant applications are currently live. So that deadline is coming up on May 1st. Go ahead and apply. I believe Monica did get a scholarship, didn't you?
A grant. I got a grant.
For it. Yeah. And then we have our Clink Wine Tasting annual fundraiser coming up on March 28th. So that's always kind of our big fundraiser for these scholarship and grant applications.
And that's March 28th, and I think you all might be coming back to talk a little bit more about that.
Of course.
But then the other big one was grant deadline, which is May 1st.
May 1st.
So people can find out all the information at jhc.org, I'm assuming?
Yes.
Okay.
We're
and
all
of course,
online.
Tonight, I mentioned at the top of the show, but tonight is also Poetry Out Loud, which the Jack is also involved in. We have some
right
11.
Here at KTOO.
I know, downstairs here at KTOO. It's 11 students from around the state competing in the recitation.
It's so exciting.
Of Poetry
it's
Out Loud.
Be great.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, it's going to be great. And you can watch it tonight. You can see it at kto.org/POL live at 5 p.m., or you can watch it later tonight on 360 TV at 8 o'clock. Okay, so I know there's a lot of First Friday events, and you can always go to the Jack. jahc.org, jahc.org/first-friday, or there's always a big button right there on the website that will have a link to it all. Because you,
that is correct.
You all keep a really good record of how many do we have this month? Is it over 30 or
man.
Where are we at?
There's got to be over 30. I don't know the exact number, but I do know the Alaska State Museum has like 5 different events going on right
yeah,
now.
They've got a lot going on. Kate was just talking about the City Museum's got 2 shows opening.
Yeah.
And any others that we want to call out, Tracy?
Yeah, so Sea Alaska always has their artist market. That's one that you always have to go to. I believe a couple of our normal vendors that we work with for all of our markets, they're going to be there as well as a couple of others. We do have... the Crystal Saloon is hosting a jazz quintet. Go check that out. That's at 6. Wicks and Stones is doing a Juno Red Cross watercolor tea party night.
Ooh, fun.
So that is a fundraiser for the Juno Red Cross.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah. And again, you can find all those events at jahc.org or on the Facebook page and all that good stuff.
Yep.
Right?
We're on Facebook and Instagram, so all of it will be up. Probably by Friday afternoon.
You know who's not on Instagram? Monica Doherty.
Let's talk to her about that.
Let's talk about that.
Absolutely true.
I was looking at, you do have an Instagram, but it hasn't been updated in quite a while because you are a self-proclaimed non-social media type person.
Yes, and also just a bad business person for my art.
Well, you can't be that bad because you have a show opening this week, which is kind of cool. And you got a grant.
It's so exciting. It's so great. And
yeah.
I'm so thankful to the Jack so I can show my work.
So let's talk a little bit about it. You are mostly what is your form? What is your...
Yeah, so I paint in oils and I've been painting in oils for a really long time, really since high school, but that's when I first kind of started learning the medium. I really enjoy working in a large scale. So the paintings that you'll see at this first Friday will be very large, like 54 by 60 inches.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so big. So it's a fun way to experience paintings. I think it's a fun way for me to paint paintings because it's very immersive. So that's kind of the very surface level what you'll should expect at the first Friday.
At the show. And what kind of things do you paint?
So I did for a long time, I kind of worked in landscape. I did these interiors of rooms for a long time, really kind of digging into sort of psychological experiences of like how we experience space and our relationship with our environments. As a lot of artists do, they change and progress. And so I kind of found myself wanting to explore something else, which was figure painting and putting figures in my artwork. And the way that I work is very intuitive. Sometimes I use photographs for reference, but I use a lot of memory, just my imagination. So like fitting in figures was very new and kind of, it was a little difficult at first. And so what I kind of started thinking about when I was working with a figure, because when you put a figure in a painting, you kind of start telling a story, which I really wasn't used to. And so I started kind of coming up with these sort of myth-like images that were coming through in a very intuitive way. So that's where this this show really lands, in this exploration of figure and myth. And I think it was a way for me to navigate, a new painting style or subject matter. And some of these paintings started in 2019, so I've really kind of been working on them on and off for a long time. And a lot's been going on, and so I think it was a way for me to kind of navigate what was going on in the world, navigate what was going on in my personal journey and my art. So that's where I kind of was really thinking for this show.
Interesting, because I love the idea that you're talking about in terms of once you add a figure, that story starts to come into play. Because you were talking about before, like working in landscape and in terms of our relationship to space, mm-hmm. right? Has there been any crossover of like taking the figure and their relationship to space in terms of how you're seeing, because you're working on such a large canvas, right?
Yeah. Not as much as I maybe expected, because I'm not putting them. A lot of these figures you'll see are in sort of a landscape. So, and I think maybe more instead of the, and the spaces are very flattened, so there's not a lot of perspective, and it's really working with, I think, more color than anything, and sort of how you relate to the colors, how the figures are in and out of sort of the emotional element of color, if I can, if that makes sense.
Has it surprised you because of the way you started and what you're saying, like it was surprising to sort of start putting figures in there and having to tell story? Did you find yourself thinking you were painting one idea and then it sort of changed as?
Yes, very, very much so. And I think especially when I got this show, and I started these when I was living in Seattle, and now I'm back in Juneau. And then I really started thinking about, and I love where this took me, which was I thought about like the history of Juneau and just how, and when we think about histories, the different types of stories that we tell ourselves, depending on your background. And one of them, for me anyways, was like, mining, like we, in some aspects of our, or very much in an aspect of our history, it's like rooted in mining, and how those stories interweave with other stories, or just how like the Perseverance Trail was formed by, you know, the seeking of gold, and those kind of, and I these topics are, I look at them very generally. The images aren't specific enough that you might pick these things up. You might or you might not. But I liked being thinking about Juneau through this context. And I kind of see it as a springboard for maybe future paintings that I can explore a little bit more in depth.
Absolutely. And well, you can see the paintings this Friday at the Juneau Artists Gallery, Juneau Arts and Culture Center in the, not the Juneau Artists Gallery, the Juneau Gallery at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. And Tracy, is there a reception and what time will it be at?
The opening reception is from 4 to 7 p.m. in the Jack Gallery.
4 to 7 p.m. on First Friday in the Jack Gallery. That's wonderful. Monica, congratulations
thank
on the
you.
Show.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see it. And yeah, thank you to the Jack. And of course, thank you to the Jack for putting it together, all the First Friday information. If you need to figure out where to go and what's on the docket for this week, you can go to jahc.org. There's usually a tab right on the homepage to show you what's happening and where you want to go that weekend. For the month of, and your show runs for the whole month of March.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Tracy, Monica, thank you so much. Gwyneth Cheesh for being here. And if you want to find out more about Monica, show up at the reception because she's not on.
I'll get my website up. I had a snafu.
You can always come talk to us at the Jack.
It's all good. We really appreciate you being here. Gwyneth Cheesh.
Thank you.
Okay, that's going to do it for today's Juneau Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, 49 Writers has an open mic in Juneau and some upcoming virtual class options. We meet this year's honorees of the AWARE Women of Distinction, and the State Museum has a special presentation and concert all about the Kimball organ in the State Office Building. Juneau Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTO Juneau 104.3 and KAUK Juneau Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. Find the show online at kto.org/JuneauAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines, Club 49, Hanson Grass, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gwyneth Cheesh.